Well, if nobody else gets anything out of this deal tonight, I have had a ball putting it together. It has been more fun for me just going back to 1956 and trying to trace the history of the U.S. Navigators and some of the events and the highlights and the people down through the last 24 years, and looking at old pictures and looking back through the archives that we have been saving, and coming up with some slides that I think are going to be quite interesting for some of you to look at, because you have really changed over the years. My executive assistant, Yvonne Anderson, came across a couple of albums just last week that have got a whole raft of pictures that go way, way back, and I put them out in the hallway on the table, the Kenya table out there, and you might want to look through them. Some of you look very peculiar in some of those pictures. In fact, we've got a whole series of pictures from I can't remember whether it was a Northern Division or a Great Lakes Region staff conference that we held here in 1970, and we had a party, a masquerade party out at the Flying W Ranch, and everybody dressed up for it, and the pictures of everybody are in that album, including Millie Hopkins and Betty Skinner, and that is worth the price of admission just to see those two gals and the way that they were dressed up that night. So feel free to look through that. Tonight, I want to just make a brief announcement, and that is that on behalf of all the U.S. staff, we have a little package of gifts. Gifts. For all of you who are here from overseas, now that's both Americans and non-Americans, and the packages are out in the hallway by the door, but I'd like to just tell you what is in it, just so you'll know what to expect. It's a combination of little things that we thought you might appreciate. A little note from me, which means nothing. We've got a new issue of the log here that you might like to look at. NAV Press has donated their latest Bible study series, God's Design for the Family. Some of you may have that, but most of you, I do not think, have it. I think you'll appreciate that and enjoy that. We've got a little picture here, which Don Enright did, of the castle with a ram's head in the foreground, and you can take that home and hang it on your study wall. I think you and your family will enjoy that. And then we've got one other thing that is, I think, very, very uniquely American, which we wanted to toss something in that is just really uniquely American, and it's a gift certificate, and it says on it, gift certificate from the U.S. staff too, and then your name is in there, and it's signed by all the proper authorities and stamped and sealed, and it's from Baskin-Robbins Ice Cream Company, 31 flavors, for a full-fledged American Baskin-Robbins banana split. Now, you've got to go over to the Baskin-Robbins on the east side of town. There's a little map that shows you how to get there. And I'm sure that any of the Americans here would be delighted to take you over there and introduce you to a Baskin-Robbins banana split. You get one free. The Americans who live in this country have to pay for it. Sorry, guys. So that's a little thing that you can pick up on your way out. They're in a package like this. Your name is on it, and we would love to have you have that. Now, I want to make a special presentation, however, to Dr. Saunders. Here is his. And Dr. Saunders, where are you? Are you here tonight? All right, here's yours. We want you to have this as a gift from the U.S. staff, because you are a non-American living outside the United States, and we want you to have this. Along with Noel, and the words that he said right at the first of his little testimony. I have great empathy with. I want you to know that I consider it a tremendous privilege to be a part of this gang. I know that all of us feel that way, but since I've got the mic tonight, I thought I'd take the opportunity to say that. I cannot express to you in words how much and how deeply I feel toward all of you. And even though we don't know one another, many of us very well, we've had the opportunity for the first time, many of us, to shake hands with one another, say a few words, take a few minutes and talk and chat. And there's a bond and a tie there that only can be had in Jesus Christ. And so I just want to express to each one of you my gratitude and thanks for the privilege I have of being a part of this wonderful gang. Now, I'm supposed to talk about the history of the Navigators tonight, but I've got an introduction that's probably going to take about 15 minutes before I get to that, and I've got some things I want to say. I'm so excited about this past weekend. Carol and I had a deal back in Indiana. It was a marriage seminar that we gave, and we've had this plan for 2.5 years. It was set in concrete before the dates for this conference were set, and as we found out about it, you know, we kind of regretted that we'd committed ourselves to a weekend right in the middle of this conference. And going home on Thursday afternoon, I was driving out to the house from here, and I was praying about the weekend and about this week of the conference, and I knew that all of us were tired. I was tired, and I was praying, now, Lord, if it would work out, I'd really appreciate it if the plane travel tomorrow on Friday would be sort of hassle-free. That, you know, we just climb on board and Continental Airlines would take us to Chicago, and then we'd get on an American Airlines flight and they'd take us down to Indianapolis and be nothing to it. Well, God must have had something else in mind because it just didn't work that way. We got out to the airport. Bob Whitmer picked us up at the house about 6:30 a.m. Friday morning. Got out to the airport about a quarter of, and we sat there because of the fog until 11:30. We were supposed to leave at 7:30. We got into Chicago, and it was snowing. We were delayed out of Chicago and finally got into Indianapolis, and we were just about the last flight to be able to land there because it was closing in with fog there. And then we had a 2.5-hour drive from Indianapolis down to French Lick, Indiana, where this conference was going to be, through fog and rain and drizzle. And we climbed out of the car in front of the hotel where this conference was to be 15 minutes before I was supposed to stand up and speak to this group of 400-plus couples. But you know, God blessed in such a unique and wonderful and exciting way that I just couldn't pass up the opportunity to tell you about it. It's probably one of the most fantastic times over a short weekend that Carol and I have ever had. Over 800 people there, many of them ready needy hearts, many non-Christians. We had the opportunity to preach the gospel to them twice. We know of a number that accepted Jesus Christ as their personal Savior. We know of marriages that were turned around as a result of the weekend. Just a couple of examples. Carol was talking to a couple on Sunday morning before the first meeting, right after breakfast, and they came to her and told her that that night they had gotten back to their room, they had gotten down on their knees before the Lord and asked Jesus Christ to come into their lives and be their Savior. And then they stayed up until 4 o'clock in the morning talking about the implications of what this would mean to them in their lives individually and as a couple together now in Christ. And then as I was walking down through the lobby of the hotel for the last meeting, there was a gentleman standing over here by himself, and as I went by him, I stopped, shook his hand, introduced myself to him, and a tear came to his eyes, and he says, Jack, I want you to know that our coming, my wife and I coming to this weekend, was a last-ditch stand. because this next week we were going to the lawyers and begin divorce proceedings. But the things that we've heard this weekend, the things that God has spoken to us about, and the way God has dealt with our lives, we feel we can begin to put these into practice, and it's going to turn our lives around. So we came home tired, but exhilarated, and absolutely fantastically thrilled. I was so tired last night when I got into Chicago. I slept all the way. I had three seats across on the plane from Chicago to Denver and went to sleep, and it seemed like it was a five-minute trip. You know, the other day, Sandy referred to his middle-age crisis at age 41. Well, some of us are kind of late bloomers, and I don't think I hit the middle-age crisis until age 50 or thereabouts. Back in the latter part of 1977, when I was looking forward in January to my 50th birthday, I began to really think seriously about the implications of turning 50 and how many years I had left. And so I've discovered that at middle age, it's when you're just as young as ever, but it just takes a lot more effort. And that's the thing that I'm discovering now that I'm past 50. And I suppose you've heard of the six ages of man. Age one is beef broth. The second age of man is ground steak. The third age, sirloin steak. The fourth, filet mignon. The fifth age, ground steak. And the sixth, beef broth. Now, I figure right now at the prime, I'm at the filet mignon stage. That is, if I could afford it, I would. And then there's the six ages of women. And the first age is of course, the infant. And then the second age, the little girl. And then the third age, the miss. And then the fourth, the young woman. And then the fifth age, the young woman. And then the sixth age, the young woman. However, I think I agree with Victor Hugo when he said, 40 is the old age of youth, and 50 is the youth of old age. And I kind of agree with that. But at age 50, I became a grandfather. Now, that was an exciting experience. At age 50, I climbed Pike's Peak for the first time. That was an exciting experience. A half a dozen of us went up the peak, Rod and Jerry Bridges and a couple of other of us, one August, bright August day. And also at age 50, God gave me a life verse. Now, that may seem kind of strange to some of you, because you've had life verses ever since you've been 5 years old. But I've always sort of envied people who had a life verse. You know, they'd get up and they'd give their testimony, and at age 27, God gave me this verse for the rest of my life. And I'd scrounge through my Bible, you know, and I would read, and I'd latch onto something that would kind of hit home, and pretty soon it began to fade, and it really didn't stick. But at age 50, God gave me a life verse, and I'm so excited about it. Some of you have heard me talk about it. 1 Timothy 3:7 and 8. Train yourself in godliness, for while bodily training is of some value, godliness is of value in every way, for it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come. And the more I've thought about that, the more I've meditated upon it, the more I realize that truly is a verse for the rest of my life. It's a verse for the rest of anybody's life. Training yourself in godliness. Godliness, of course, touches on every aspect of our living. There is no area of our life that we can point to or put our finger on that godliness does not play a part. And it is a continual challenge to me. Ever since those last days of 1977, when God began to lay that verse on my heart, to continue to study it and think about it and begin and continue to apply it to my own life. And you know, I was elated about that, and then a little over a year ago, Carol and I were out in California, and we were spending some days alone with the Lord just to read His Word and pray and talk and think and write. And I felt that I wanted something fresh and new from the Lord, and I was reading through Exodus, and I came to chapter 33, the chapter that Dr. Sanders spoke on the other night, and his exposition of that chapter was just an absolute new, fresh revelation to me. He saw so many things in it that I didn't see, even though I've spent hours in it. But two verses out of that the Lord gave me in January of 1979, and it was sort of a verse for the year. Now, He gave me a verse for the rest of my life, and then He gave me a verse for the next year. And I things were going so great, I could hardly believe it. But time and time again, I've gone back to verses 14 and 17 from Exodus 33 over the last many, many months, where God, in that very, very difficult situation that Moses found himself in, says, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. I will do the very thing you have asked, because I am pleased with you, and I know you by name." It is a fantastic thought to me that He knows me by name. And it's the desire of my heart to always do those things that please Him, so that He can continue to say, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. I will do the very thing you've asked, because I am pleased with you." Oh, I know I blow it on that, but how grateful I am for 1 John 1:9, huh? When I can come right back into His presence and His fellowship. And then, you know, I couldn't have asked for anything more than that. And then this year, God gave me another verse for the year. You know, you go through for years, and I'm so excited about this one. But right near the end of last year, the Lord began to lay Psalm 37, 4, and 5 on my heart, just as a result of going over it in some back review verses. "Delight thyself also in the Lord, and He shall give thee the desires of thine heart. Commit thy way unto the Lord, trust also in Him, and He shall bring it to pass." And that first verse, verse 4, I've taken as referring to my life. "Delight thyself also in the Lord, and He shall give thee the desires of thine heart." And then the fifth verse, for my job, for my work, for my ministry. "Commit thy way unto the Lord, trust also in Him." It's a work of faith, and He shall bring it to pass. And so those are some things that have been exciting me in these past few days. I was so excited the other night when Nabil was talking, and he made that statement that he was a Christian first, a navigator second, and an Arab third. I like that, because that's the way I feel. I'm a Christian first, a navigator second, and an American third, or maybe fourth or fifth or something else. I thought of several other things, though, that I am in addition to that, and I'm not sure where American really does fit in all of the priorities, because not only am I a navigator, I'm a navigator staff person. I now find that I am the parent of a navigator staff person, which in itself is an exciting thing. It has been rather trying, though. Some of you haven't had the experience yet of being on the navigator staff and at the same time having a child who is connected with the navigators in their ministry someplace. And they give you a phone call a couple of days before Thanksgiving or a week before Thanksgiving, and they say, "Hey, Dad, the navigators are going to have a conference over Thanksgiving weekend, and I'm sorry I won't be able to get home for Thanksgiving." Now, as a parent, I have gotten ticked off at the navigators several times because of things like that. And she would come home for Christmas vacation, and then a couple of days after she'd been there, she'd get up the courage to tell us that she had to leave the day after Christmas in order to make it in time to be there for a navigator conference someplace 200 or 300 miles away. So I have great empathy for the parents of some of the people that we are working with. They have reason sometimes to be a little uptight with us as navigators. But then also, I have a daughter and a son-in-law. Carol and I always wanted a son. We never had one. But now we feel we've got one. Our son-in-law, Tim Westberg, is a joy to our hearts. He's a wonderful guy. And more, he and I are becoming buddies with one another. So I feel I've got a son. And they're now navigator missionaries. I don't know whether George Sanchez and I have an exclusive club going in that respect or not, but I feel very privileged, and I know George does, to have a child, an offspring, on the mission field in the behalf of Christ's kingdom, and especially with the vision of the Navs on their hearts. But also, I've got a grandson on the mission field, and that really excites me. He's only 2 years old, but boy, I tell you, he is going to be some guy. So I get all these things mixed up, you know, and the priorities, whether I'm a Christian first or a navigator second or an American, but I'm a grandfather, I know that, and I got missionary kids, and so all this is very wonderful. Well, that's my introduction. I just had to share something like that to kind of get warmed up. Where I want to begin in trying to relate some of the incidents that have occurred in the history of the U.S. navigator work goes all the way back to 1956. Now, there is no way that with all that has happened and all that God has done down through the years that we could cover everything or talk about everybody or relate every incident. And so there are going to be many things left out, and I'm sure that some of you who are sitting there and who are familiar with some of this, you're going to say, well, I wonder why I didn't mention that and that by the time I get finished. Well, it's because I didn't think of it, or the emphasis wasn't right or something. But there are many, many people who have had a very significant part to play in what God has done down through the years in pouring out His blessing on the ministry of the Navs in the U.S., And all of us who have had a part of it simply feel that it's God's grace, it's His mercy, and it's been His leading and His doing. Doss Troutman died in June of 1956. That was the same year that George Sanchez and myself came on the staff. I think we were probably about the last two people that Doss personally invited to come on the NAV staff before his death. And I can remember in January of 1956, first meeting Dawson Troutman up in Portland, Oregon. I had run into a guy by the name of Skip Gray, and Skip handed me a little pasteboard packet of scripture memory verses over lunch one day and suggested that I start memorizing scripture. And I thought, who in the world is this guy to ask me to do this? But I did. I memorized them, and they meant a great deal to my life. And we met the next week, and he had the audacity to ask me how I'd done, wanted to check up on me. So he did, and I had the verses memorized, and he gave me 8 more, and we just kept going like that. Skip and I had 4 wonderful months together up there in Portland, and that was my introduction to the navigators. And shortly after that, Doss Troutman came to town. Doug Coe, who was the representative in Salem, Oregon at that time, brought him up to Portland. He spoke in the church where I was a youth director at that time, the Central Bible Church in Portland, Oregon. And during the course of a conversation that lasted for about an hour in our living room, Doss just casually mentioned, someday it'd be great if you and Carol were on the navigator staff. And we didn't think much about it at the time. But over the period of the next few months, the Lord began to work in our hearts. And to make a long story short, Doss invited me to come down to a conference here the last week in May of 1956 and spend time with him and just talk about the possibility of our future. And we spent many, many hours together. One afternoon, I remember especially, we spent over in the Pink House, the bedroom that he and Lila had on this end of the pink house. It's a huge room. It's probably almost as big as this room. And he shared with me hour after hour after hour the history of the Navigators, and particularly since 1949 and what had happened overseas. And he had a double-barrel 410 shotgun in the bedroom, and the French doors were open, and at that particular time there were a lot of magpies around. There still are a lot of magpies around. And he kept telling me, now he says, if you see a magpie out there, well, let me know. And so every once in a while I'd see a magpie, and he'd pick up the 410 shotgun, walk over to the French door, and go, "Booey!" And he'd blow this magpie out of existence. And then he'd continue with his story about the Navigators and the history of the Navigators. Well, that was my introduction to Doss Troutman. And I know that many of you have unusual tales to tell about Doss and the impact that he had on your life. And the real impact that he had was at the end of that session that afternoon, we prayed together, and he left the decision with me as to whether we were going to leave the church in Portland and come with the Navs or stay there. And that night, it was a Thursday, that night I remember walking the island. You know what the island is out here. And it wasn't paved in those days. It was still dirt roads. And I don't know how many times I walked around the island praying about whether we should come with the Navigators at that time. And it was about midnight, I imagine, and I began to sense within me a real spirit of peace that, yes, we should leave the church in Portland and come with the Navs. And by the time I went to bed that night, I was thoroughly convinced that that's what God had for Carol and me. And so the next morning, I marched into Doss's office, ready to tell him exactly what we thought we should do. We were going to come on the staff, move to Glen Eyrie, get all the training they could give us, and then we'd go out in some Navigator ministry someplace. So I sat down in his office, and he proceeded to tell us, after I had told him, and he just assumed that we were going to come with the Navs. I mean, he'd already prayed about it, and it was a foregone conclusion, apparently, to him. That's how close he walked with the Lord, I guess. And he announced that we were going to go to the Long Beach Servicemen's Center and direct that. Well, I'd never been in the military in my life. I didn't know one stripe from another on a sailor's uniform. And I didn't know any better, so I argued with him. And we went back and forth for about 15 or 20 minutes, and finally I kept trying to tell him that I didn't know enough. I hadn't had any training. 4 months with Skip Gray, you know, that's great, but it's not the whole ball of wax. And so I told him, what we need is to come here and get training. And finally, I could tell he got a little disgusted with me. He says, "Mayhall, you know enough to start." And I thought about that, and I thought, well, I can't argue with that. I do know enough to start. That's about all, but I know enough to start. And so we ended up going to Long Beach, California, and directing a servicemen's center as our first assignment in the Navigators. And the reason I tell you that story is because that's kind of the way things happen in those days. You know, wasn't any big deal made about it. You just walked into somebody's office and they said, "You do this or you do that." And, you know, if you argued, why, you had a word of prayer and you went. Training, really, from the standpoint of what we know about it today, was an unknown factor in those days. Carol and I got home and I told Carol about this, and then 2 weeks later, Doss died. And that was a real crushing blow to me, because I'd never met Lawrence Annie. And a good night, I didn't even know whether Doss had told him that he had invited us on the staff. And so I got a hold of Bob Foster, talked to him, and he says, "Well, Jack, if there's any way you could make it to the staff conference in July, that'd be great." And so we did. We packed up all of our goods, and Dr. Jack Mitchell, the pastor in Oregon that we were working with there, said, gave us God's blessing on it. We packed all of our stuff in a trailer, hooked it up to our car, drove to Long Beach, left it there in front of the Long Beach home. We had never been inside of a Navigator home. We had never lived in a home. We didn't know what a Navigator home was. But we inherited one as our first assignment in Long Beach, and we had four guys and two couples living with us, whom we met when we pulled up in front of the house, including a dog that went with the whole thing. And we met these four guys and these two couples and introduced ourselves, sat down and had a cup of coffee, left the trailer there for them to unload, and we climbed in the car and drove straight through to Glen Eyrie here in order to get here in time to be here for that first staff conference in 1956, which was the first staff conference after Doss had gone to be with the Lord. And that was the first time I met Sanny. And I can remember a little conversation that he and I had down in the foyer of the castle when we had met. And he said, "What do you got on your heart?" And I said, "The Philippines." And so we talked about that a little bit. And finally he said, "The Philippines, huh?" He says, "What about the rest of the world?" Well, I thought that was a good thought. What about the rest of the world? You know? Carol and I have been trying to get an overseas assignment for the last 24 years. We volunteered many times. We thought we had it made one time. It was about a 95% sure deal. In fact, Carol even had a farewell party given to her by some friends in Chicago, and then the Navigators changed their minds. So we've never made it as missionaries, but we sure have a missionary heart and spirit. Well, let's see. Glen Eyrie in those days was the big training center of the Navigators. From 1954 to 1964, that 10-year period of time, this was the training center for the Navigators. And over that 10-year period of time, there were a little over 1,800 people came through here for training. And, you know, it would last anywhere from a month to 2 or 3 years, just depending upon who they were and what their need was and what the situation was. And God really used it in a very magnificent way. In 1956, there were 83 people at Glen Eyrie, and that included all the trainees, plus the people who ran Glen Eyrie, plus the conference program, plus what would now be the equivalent of NAV Press, which isn't even a comparison. It was, we had a little material sales department in those days, and what would be the equivalent of the International headquarters and the U.S. headquarters, which was all amalgamated into one. There was no differentiation. 83 people. Most of those were trainees. And then in August of 1956, Lauren Sanny asked Bob Foster to coordinate the U.S. ministries while continuing to direct the Los Angeles Navigator ministry. Now, here is what Bob Foster had to coordinate. This is really a big deal. That was it. That's what Bob Foster coordinated. 48 people, including wives, in the United States. And at that time, there were 39 people, including wives, overseas. It was all one big glob. And as you can see, there's an awful lot of unfilled geography there. So Bob took the challenge, and he became the U.S. coordinator. Okay, you can turn that light back on now. Now, some of the things that happened to us in those early days, by us, I mean Carol and I, were very typical of what happened all across the country to a lot of people. And so if you'll excuse some of the personal illustrations, but just make the application to those few dots that you see, because what happened to us was pretty typical of how people got asked to move and just pick up and leave. And our great commission in those days was go get some men. That was it. All this stuff in the FOM and reams of paper and the guide, you know, the lining across with the yellow deals, you know. We never had any of that in those days. There wasn't any such guy as Donald McGilchrist. And so after a couple of years in Long Beach, we were asked to move back here to Glen Eyrie and get some training. And so for two summers, on both ends of the little over a year that we were here, I was involved in the conference program, and then during the off-season, the conference off-season, I ran the print shop. Sandy had some brainstorm of an idea that anybody who knew how to manage people or lead people could run anything. You didn't need any technical skill. Well, that was one of his lesser lights as a decision with me running the print shop. We gave that up after a very short period of time. And then in August, or just prior to August of 1959, Lauren asked Carol and I to pray about moving back to Wheaton, which we did. And I can remember very distinctly one Sunday afternoon sitting out here on the porch of the schoolhouse across the moat here, praying over this and God giving me some promises from Genesis in heading back to Wheaton in a new ministry. And when it all was said and done, and I was talking to Lauren, and I said, "Now, tell me one more time, what is my job?" It was, go get some men. That was it. Didn't make any difference what kind. You know, were they collegiates, businessmen, military. You pick them out of the Chicago area. You figure out where you should minister. You settle wherever you... Although they'd pretty well picked on Wheaton because we'd graduated from Wheaton. And at that time, at that period of time, we were just beginning to dabble in the collegiate ministry. Leroy was beginning to get something going at the University of Nebraska. Russ Johnson, he wasn't on the staff at that time, but he was at Iowa State, and Leroy would go over to Iowa State and help him. Jerry Marshall was up at the University of Minnesota, and there were half a dozen other guys around the country who were very gingerly beginning to try and eke their way into a collegiate ministry, none of us knowing what we were doing. In fact, I graduated from a Christian college, and I had only been on a secular campus twice in my life prior to moving back there. I had never been in a fraternity in my life. And, well, I'll tell you about that in a minute. But anyway, so we packed up all of our possessions and climbed in our little red Volkswagen and started back to Wheaton, and we got to Colby, Kansas, and blew a valve on the Volkswagen. And I went to every garage in Colby, Kansas, and nobody knew how to work on a Volkswagen in those days. That was 1959. And so in desperation, I called back here to the Glen and got a hold of Jim Downing, and he said, "Well, get a place to stay overnight, and we'll send somebody out to give you a hand." And so we found a little cheap motel, and Lynn and Carol and I stayed overnight. And the next morning, about 10 o'clock, Russ Johnston shows up with the big flatbed truck from Glen Eyrie. And so we found one of these ramps where they run farm machinery up to get it on a truck, and we got the Volkswagen started on three cylinders and backed it up that ramp and got it onto the flatbed truck and chained it down. Now, this was the middle of August, 100 degrees heat out in the middle of Kansas, and Carol and Lynn and myself and Russ Johnson climbed in the cab of the truck and came all the way back to Glen Eyrie, about, I don't know how far it is to Colby, a couple of hundred miles, maybe 250, something like that. Got back here, got the thing fixed, started out again in a little red Volkswagen and made it all the way to Wheaton. Found a place to live. We've got a two-bedroom apartment that was the upstairs of an old house. It was really all bedrooms, just made over into an apartment. The kitchen, the dining room, and the bathroom was off of that. Very interesting time when you're having a dinner party and somebody had to go to the bathroom. You could take a marble and put it on one corner and it would roll quite rapidly across the floor. Lynn's room was rather a small bedroom. She slept on one of these hide-a-beds that pull out, and when the hide-a-bed was out, it was wall-to-wall bed. Our living room served as a guest room, and we had such dignitaries in those days come through and sleep on that old green hide-a-bed as Lauren Sanney and Lila Trotman and Bob Foster. Rod Sargent. Boy, that was big stuff in those days. I tell you, man, those when those guys came to town, man, it was really a flag-waving day. And then in 1960, Leroy Imes became the U.S. coordinator. In the U.S., at that time, we had grown just a little bit, and here's what Leroy took over as the U.S. coordinator. Now, the blue dots represent new works since the last map. So this is 4 years later, and you can see we're really growing at a rapid rate. That's what Leroy coordinated. Fantastic, isn't it? Huh. And we had 48 field staff, including wives, in the U.S. in 1956, and we grew to 59 by 60, a 23% increase. And we had 39 people overseas in 1956, and by 1960 we had 54, an increase of 38%. So we really were growing. Now, Leroy, I'd like to have Lee just stand up and say a word. And Lee, what did Sani ask you to do as the U.S. coordinator? And what were some of the highlights during that period of time?
That's very simple. When Jack asked me to try to think through on what it was like in those days and what I did, I jotted down on a piece of paper here. As best as I can remember, the situation that I inherited and what I was told to do. In the 1950s, we were a service organization. That meant we served other organizations. And we didn't follow up for other people, and we were often loaned to other organizations to do their work for them or to help them do their work. For instance, Bill Bright has come to Dawson Trumbull and asked for some people to help get Campus Crusades for Christ started. And I was one of those that was loaned to him. That's how I began a collegiate ministry at the University of Pittsburgh. Then in 1956, I went to Omaha, Nebraska to start to work in the Midwest. Well, typically, I began to help Young Life do their work, and Youth for Christ do their work, and so on and on. And a young man named David Dawson had come to Christ through Youth for Christ down in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Bob Stevens and I would go down and follow him up and help him grow as a Christian. And while I was in Lincoln, I saw all those great big dormitories sitting there. And I would go on that Air Force base, and there would be all those barracks. And I got an idea. I thought, wouldn't it be neat just to go into those places and begin to thrash around and give the gospel and see what would happen? I mean, if we did that on our own without being part of somebody else's organization. So we did that. We moved down there. And in those days, whenever there was a move, it always happened in the summer at the banquet, the staff conference banquet. So here was Waldron Scott going to Cyprus, and Jake Combs going to Taiwan, and all this, and Leroy and Virginia going from Omaha to Lincoln. Philadelphia to Penn State, where there was a big university. We moved her from Kansas City to Kansas, to Manhattan, where Kansas State was located. And so on, all across America. And so we began to work on this pool of manpower. And so that was my job in the U.S. In the 60s. Well, one other thought. Also in those years, we began to get the germ idea, the seed, of a contact point. Somebody could go to this one of these pools and begin to work that way. And so that also emerged. So the pool of manpower idea emerged, the contact point idea emerged. But my basic job was just as a U.S. coordinator, was to get the staff out into the grassroots ministry in these pools of manpower and sort of get on with the Great Commission. And we had lots of fun in those days. Thank you, Jack.
Leroy was a great help to many of us in those days. He'd come blowing through town, and he'd always have some new wild idea that he wanted to try. And he'd come through one time, and I remember he says, "Now, Jack, what you got to do is you got to get an inside man." I said, "What?" "An inside man." And then he'd begin to talk about this big dorm and how you got to have somebody inside of there that's with you, that's for you, that's a booster, and can kind of handle things. And so many of the concepts that we still use in the collegiate ministry grew out of those early days. I remember one time Lee came through and he says, "Jack, we're going to go over to Northern Illinois University and we're going to have a dorm meeting." And so he told me how to get it all set up, and we got it set up, and he and I were going to do it. He set me down and gave me instructions on how to do it. And we kind of teamed up. And the dorm meeting was held in the cafeteria of the dorm starting about 10:30 at night. And he would preach for a while, and then I would preach for a while. And then he'd preach for a while, and I'd preach for a while. And then we opened it up for questions, and he'd handle them for a while, and I'd handle them for a while. And it was getting to be about midnight. And we'd had a great time, but everybody was kind of punchy and tired, including the two of us, and it was my turn to answer questions, and some guy raised his hand, or I had made some comment about what is truth, and because somebody had asked a question about it, and somebody had said, "What is truth?" And my response to it was, "Well, you know, that's what Pilate asked." And some guy who had just walked in raised his hand, and he says, "Hey, I wasn't here when Pilate asked that question." And I turned around and looked at Leroy, and literally he was laying on the floor laughing. It was about that same time that Dave Johnson had just gotten involved in the ministry down at Indiana University, and he had made some contacts at a couple of fraternity houses, and he got real excited about having a fraternity, an evangelistic fraternity meeting. And he wrote me, and he says, "Jack, we've got this thing planned, and we've got the right contacts, but we don't know what to do. We'd like to have you come down and speak and help us set this thing up." I'd been in one fraternity in my whole life. I didn't know anything more about a fraternity meeting than flying to the moon. So what did I do? Well, I wrote Leroy. I mean, Leroy had all the answers in those days. And a few days later, in the mail, I got this great big thick packet. It was as thick as that one I gave Dr. Sanders. And it was full of paper. And it was a detailed outline of step-by-step what you do to set up a fraternity meeting, including the message that you bring. And so I wrote Dave Johnson and outlined this whole thing for him, told him exactly step by step how to do it. And you have four guys go in and you have dinner with them, and one guy MCs and two testimonies and one guy speaks and how you close it off and how you get appointments afterwards and so forth. We had all this outlined, and I drove down to Indiana University, about a 6-hour drive, and all the way down I was memorizing this message, word for word. And got there, and you know, I pretended like this was something I'd do every week. And we went into that fraternity that night and had dinner with those guys and put on that meeting. And boy, God blessed. It just literally put us on cloud nine. There were six guys trusted Christ between that night and the next noon that we made appointments with. And we began to follow up on them, and that was one of the things that began to just open up the ministry at Indiana University. And this type of thing was beginning to happen right during those days all over the country. Because as Lee said, Sandy told him, just go out and teach everybody else how to do what you're doing. And that's what he did. And, you know, we were all learning together. Now, I'd like to show you some slides now from about 1956 up to about the mid-60s. And some of you will recognize some of these people. Also, another thing that was happening during the middle part of the 60s and even into the late 60s was it was sort of the era of the big deals. And we had things called the Hayloft Opera and a Hootenanny with a Purpose. And Dave Dawson put on a deal down at Illinois State called An Evening in Space. Dave, stand right where you are. Just take a couple of minutes and tell them about that.
That was back in the days when they were trying to put a man on the moon, and what we were doing in space was the biggest thing. And I just met Bob Hayden, who had become a Christian, who was in charge of the Mercury or the Penguin program, which was one of the middle stages of actually putting the man on the moon. And I asked him if he would come to Illinois State, and I gave him this idea of how we would use him and try and get all the students on our campus out. And so we came up with the idea that we would build a space capsule, and in the middle of the night put that on the campus. We got a parachute from the government and somebody's big truck that had a boom, and we break this thing. We had gone to the university officials and the police department, so that the next morning when students walked into that campus, there was a police car out there with a big red light going around, the radio station, you know, with their emergency vehicle there to get all the latest news, and that whole thing, you know, cordoned off. So the people, you know, literally thought that that capsule...
And then we had a wing ding here in this room, and you're going to see some pictures of that. There, we jammed almost 700 guys in this place. John Crawford and his crew built scaffolding all the way around these walls. We had chairs up there on the mantle. We had another wing ding up at Estes Park that just about froze everybody out. I think most people went away from there with the flu. But those were some of the things that were happening during these days. Now let's have the lights, and we'll take a look at some of these pictures. Now, some of you guys are going to have to help me on who some of these people are, but this is a staff conference in 1956, the first one that George Sanchez, I think, attended, Dan Pyatt, Roy Robertson, and let's see, now, who is this guy? There's Dan and Roy. And here is the Dendler twins, Dean and Jean, their wives, Roy Robertson, George and Florine, Dan Pyatt and his wife, and Pete George, right. Now, a little better focus on that. I think this is the gang that was going overseas at that staff conference in 1956. Right. Sanchez is there, Joyce Turner. Joyce Turner right there. Roy Robertson. Gordy Nordstrom. Bob Wilbraham. And this is the area, the West Coast Area Reps Conference in 1957 or 8. Thank you. That was the U.S. work in those days, boy. Now, here's the red Volkswagen that we went to Wheaton in. That was the winter before we left. That's what happened out here in Colorado. And that was the area reps conference the next year. Gene Tabor, Soderbergh. Do you recognize this guy here? Boy, those hairstyles sure changed, don't they? Now, this is a historic house. This is in Wheaton, Illinois, in 1962 of January. And in January of 1962 in Wheaton, Illinois, in that house, we had the National Area Representatives Conference for the Navigators. We slept there. We ate there. We had our meetings there. We got the flu there. We had one bedroom dedicated to those who got the green mist. And this is some of the bunch that were there. Cease Davidson, Harvey Oslin, Chuck Farah, Jim White, Stan Bostrom, Leroy, Jerry Marshall, Roy Sherwood, Gene Tabor, Repco, White. And then we went out to eat one night. If you can believe it, that is at George Diamond's restaurant. Wouldn't Chuck Unger love that picture? That was a conference over at Lake Wawasee along about 63, 64, sometime in there. And I think that was the last time Leroy and I did that together until the other night. Here were our cooks. Those were our cooks at that conference. And this is the wingding here in the Great Hall. You can see the scaffolding. This is Leroy, I think, emceeing the thing. This is the luggage coming in on the train station downtown. A bunch of us in the Midwest went together and rented several cars on a train and came out on the train. And on the way out, we had seminars in different cars on the train. And Dave Dawson set up one of the box cars as a sort of a snack shop and served us food. There are the guys up on the mantle. There's the train. Any of you recognize this guy right here? Dick Fisher. And that was our reception committee. And there's the balcony with the scaffolding in front of the balcony. Okay. Lights, please. More fun, huh? Well, a very significant thing happened in 1965. Skip and Buzzy Gray had been down in Costa Rica for several years, and they were invited back by Sani and took over the southeast region. And some very significant things happened with our military ministry as a result of that, and I've asked Skip to say a word about some of the highlights as he views it back in those days from 1965 up until the late 60s, and some of the things that God did. Skip?
Back to Buzzy and I came home on a 90-day furlough from Costa Rica on our way to Venezuela. Got a call from George, typical navigator operation, and suggested that we might stay in the U.S. And as you can imagine, even though the Nav work began in the armed forces, among men in the Navy particularly, with Leroy and Jack in the Midwest, the whole thrust of the work moved towards collegiate ministry. And I came back to an area reps conference in, kind of 65 sometime.
About 65, yeah.
And there were three or four guys working with men in the armed forces, kind of off in a corner. And then the collegiate guys were talking about evening in space and wingdings and big deals. And I mean, the whole spirit of the work was collegiate. And Lorne asked me, Buzzy and I, and Ron and Betty. Is that right? It was Ron and Betty in those days. I wrote to Ron not too long ago, wrote Ron and Betty, and he wrote back and said her name was Joyce. It was Ron and Betty in those days. And we went down there, and God gave a promise, Leviticus 26, 8 and 9, 5 of you shall chase 100, 100 of you for 10,000 flight. And God began to move and raise up men in the armed forces and to bring the work back into balance so that the collegiate military would both contribute to the objectives of laborers. Down there for a few months, came back to a staff conference, and Lauren said, I need 27 couples to go overseas in the next few years. We had about 25 single guys. So back down, and Ron and I spent about 3 days together alone with God in prayer, seeking God. We made a list. We said, what couples do we know? And so we made a list of about 20 names, and divvied them up, 10 couples for Ron, 10 for me. And then we began to travel and exercise the gift of recruiting. Asking people, what are you going to do with your life? What are you going to say to God the night before you die? Simple little things like that.
Thanks, Skip. Let's stand and take just a brief break. Don't run away, but okay, let's be seated, please. At this same time, while all of these things were going on and the new things that we were learning in the ministry, there were also some organizational changes taking place in the U.S. work, and we were moving into this thing called regions. And none of us really knew what it was. It was just kind of a way of dividing things up. But about that time, Lauren asked Rod Sargent to become the U.S. coordinator. And when he took over, we were divided into these regions. And I think about the time Rod took over, there were seven regions. And I couldn't find exactly how the states were divided, but this is roughly how it was. Russ Johnson had the Northwest. I'm not sure where California fitted into it. Leroy had the Rocky Mountain. Walt Hendricks had moved down to the Southwest. Skip was in the Southeast. Jim White was in D.C. and had all of the Northeast there. I had the Midwest and what was called the Great Lakes region, and Warren Myers had the Midwest. And as you can see, the blue dots still indicate continued growth. And most of that growth is into the collegiate and the military ministry at this time. We were moving away from the big city complexes and moving into the small town with a big dormitory or the small town with a big military base. So that was the direction we were headed. So I'd like to ask Rod if he would just stand and say a word about what were some of the things that we were learning during those days.
Well, for the sake of clarification, could I say a word about magpies? Magpies are not foreigners or nationals or human beings, but magpies are birds. Indiscriminately shoot birds either, because he understood that magpies never built their own nests, and when they wanted a nest, they would destroy the eggs or the young of other birds, and they would kill other birds. So you see, in his shooting of magpies, he was really being very humanitarian. And that's the background on the magpie story. My hazy recollections of those distant days when I was the U.S. coordinator are dim indeed. But I do recall when Sandy developed his conviction that the U.S. ministries, that in the U.S. ministries, we had reached the place where we needed to divide the work into regions. And he shared this with those of us who were at headquarters. And then he called in some of our top leadership. And as I recall, when he presented this idea, it went over like a ham sandwich in a synagogue. It was just no response. Now, this is my recollection, and I may be mistaken. But as Sandy often does, he sows his ideas, and then he waits for the rest of us to buy the concept and to understand it and to recognize its value. And it was either a matter of days or weeks. Jack came along and he said, I think I would like to experiment with this concept of a region. And so it was about then that we divided the U.S. up into different regions, and our top men each took one of these regions. So, as I recall, my first encounter with these men was in meeting. We would schedule our regional directors' meetings here in Colorado Springs in order to do our business. And, of course, we had never done this before, and we had to learn how to work together. I recall that there were various ideas on how we ought to run these meetings. For instance, one of the fellows wanted to know if we couldn't begin our sessions about mid-morning, because this would give him an opportunity to do his Bible reading, his memory work, his review, and his jogging, as he always did at home. And you know, those things are all much more important than these dumb meetings. So that was sort of the spirit of the age. I don't know that it's changed all that much. Another thought that I recall was that I, as the leader of this little group, I labored under the misconception that if we could get through our agenda without any serious disagreements, that we had had a success. of course, we gradually learned that some of the best solutions come out of meetings where there are decided differences of opinion, but that was one of the things that we had to learn. We also had to learn how to coordinate our personnel moves. And in those days, just about everybody got moved every 2 years. Come out, this was considered very good cross training. our philosophy. And I also recall that one of the decisions that we made as a group was that what we needed to do at that particular time was to identify the men on our staff throughout the U.S. who obviously did not have the gifts to do the navigator work. And then we decided what we have to do is to encourage them to find employment elsewhere. And we did this with some of these people. And it fell our lot to have to talk to them, and there were tears often when we talked with some of these men. But I think, as I recall now, as I think back on the men that we shared this with and who moved on into other types of work, without exception, they told us later that was the right decision. And many of them said later, well, I may not be in a full-time ministry now. I may be employed on a full-time basis, but I'm having a more significant ministry now than I did when I was a full-time navigator. Well, this was the beginning of our learning how to use our regions to manage effectively. And considering how little we knew about it, I think it's a monument to the grace of God that we survived.
I would agree with Rod that it is by God's grace that we have survived. All the mistakes that we made, all the dumb things that we tried to do, but in spite of it, God put his hand on it. I'm glad that Rod explained that about magpies. It just didn't dawn on me that some of you might think that what kind of things Doss was shooting. I do remember the first time that we lived here in the late 50s, and John Crawford was then in charge of the Glen, or in charge of some part of it anyway. And I would borrow Rod's double-barrel 410 shotgun once in a while, and in those days we could do this and just go hunt magpies. It was kind of fun, just around the Glen, and you find them and shoot them. And they were bad birds anyway. And I was up here by the cow barns. Now, I don't know whether you guys know, there's three of them in a row. And I was walking up in that direction, and I saw a magpie fly down between two of the cow barns. And, boy, I thought, man, I am going to get him. And so I very stealthily crept up around the first cow barn and peeked around the corner, and there he was. And the minute I peeked around, he took off, and, man, I raised that gun, and I blew him right out of the sky. The problem was I didn't quite wait long enough because I not only got the bird, but I put a nice pattern on the side of the cow barn. And I had to go confess to John Crawford and tell him exactly what had happened, and he didn't get upset about it at all. He just says, well, come with me, Jack. And we went down here to the shop, and he got a bucket of whitewash, and he handed it to me and a paintbrush, and he says, here, just go take care of it. That's what I like about John. He has a very simple way of handling things. Well, in 1969, we went to three divisions in the U.S., and I can't remember all of the circumstances that caused this to happen, but Leroy and Skip and myself were appointed the three divisional directors in the U.S., and that's organizationally sort of how it looked. Leroy had the Western Division, Skip had the Southern Division, and I had the Northern Division. Very original titles for those divisions. And you can also see how the work has begun to grow, though. The blue dots represent the increase in number of ministry and staff over the last 4 to 5 years. And so this was a period of time of quite rapid development of the ministry in the U.S. In fact, during those four years, we went from about 100 field staff in the U.S. to 200, a little over 200, and from 73 overseas to 92. I was trying to think through on what were some of the highlights of this period when we were in the divisions and what were the significant things that happened, and I picked out about five. Number one, we were practicing the things that we had learned during the early and the middle 60s. We'd, most of us in the work at that time had come up through it. We'd learned a lot from Leroy. We'd learned from Skip and from others who had pioneered in various aspects of the ministry. And we were learning and putting into practice the things we'd learned. Secondly, we'd begun to do a much better job of training and developing staff. It was during that period of time that the idea of intensifying our efforts to develop and train staff for the ministry came into being. Thirdly, the collegiate and the military ministries were growing rapidly. Fourth, we were struggling with a mission strategy. That is, how many resources to keep at home and how many to send overseas. And we went through round after round of discussions on this and trying to analyze what kind of percentages we should work on and how we should do this and where the money was going to come from. And then fifthly, it was predominantly a period of internal growth within the United States. We still continued to send, but the sending ratio was far less than that which we were developing within the U.S. itself. And then in the early 70s, let's see, did I skip something here? Yeah, I did. I wanted to show you some more slides, 66, 67, and 68, which I think you'll enjoy. And then I'll come to the 70s. Let's just flip the lights for a second. This will just take a minute. Oops. Now there... This was our new leader. But he always didn't get along with his staff too well. I think that Warren Myers is refereeing. Some hairstyles change and then some don't. But one thing that really changed was the life of Rod Sargent. And the life of the Sannies. They got a brand new automobile. Contributed by the staff all over the U.S. and I think all over the world, really. And then there were some of us that had some hard times in those days, getting pies thrown at us. This was one of the staff conferences in the late 60s. I'm not exactly sure what year, but the great hall here, as you can see, was decorated in Oriental style. Some of the guests of honor. And then some of the more popular comedians in those days. On the right there, you have Bob Badano, and on the left, you know who that is? Rod Sargent. And then there were others who didn't do too well. The Mad Doctor. And then our musical duo, Jim Downing and John Crawford. Cece Davidson on the right, Jerry Bridges in the middle, and I think that's Warren Myers. Now here was the, I think this is the overseas, or all of the regional directors, or overseas RDs, okay, yeah. That would have been in the late 60s. This was the U.S. reps in the late 60s. It's the other half. And then about 1968, I think it was, we had a Dr. Pondorf here, and we had a big conference with all the top leadership from around the world here, and he put us through some stress testing. Now, I'm not sure what White House is doing there with Walt Hendrickson, but it was part of the program, I guess. And here are some of the people who were there. Now, Bob Lewis? Mert Martin and Don Lanier? Our missionary to France? Strip Matter from Down Under? Our Dutchman? And then the man from Canada. And then we have the Marine Corps represented here. A little closer shot. Do you know who that is? Skip Gray, in person. And then this is a more relaxed time with after Dr. Pondorf had worked us over and some of the guys were watching television. Really an alive bunch, you can tell, huh? How do you like Jim Peterson's haircut there? Isn't that a beauty? Greasy kid stuff he used to use in those days. And I thought you might like to see this. This was the castle before the roads were paved and before the other bridge was put in to have the circular drive. That's it. Now, in the early 70s, Sani had begun to feel the need for a single U.S. director, and so in 1973, and I'm going to hurry through the rest of this, he appointed Skip as the U.S. director responsible for all the field ministries. Leroy, who was the Western Divisional Director soon after that, he stayed on and as the Divisional Director for a short time and then began to travel the world as the Director of Evangelism for the Navigators. Carol and I moved from the Midwest back here to Colorado, and I took a job at headquarters, partly working for Sani and partly responsible for the U.S. administration. And when Skip took over, after a short period of time to get things settled down, the U.S. developed into five regions, and here's what it looked like in June of 1974. And as you can see, the ministry has expanded, and we've divided into five regions. During those years, to me, there are three things that were outstanding. The community ministry began to really emerge and come into its own. There was a much greater decentralization of everything within the U.S. work as a result of the five regions and the responsibilities that the five RDs had. And then headquarters functions began to get sorted out and clarified. Everything had sort of been amalgamated together here at headquarters, and we began to sort things out and pull them apart. And then in 1976, Sani asked me to become the U.S. director, and I've had that job for 3.5 years now. And when I took over, it was pretty much the same organizationally as it was when Skip had it. There were very few changes that really had taken place. Jerry White had become a regional director for two of the regions, and there were some other minor changes that had taken place, but it was pretty much the same. But still there was growth taking place, represented by the blue dots. And God was prospering the ministry on an individual place-by-place basis. If I could just enumerate quickly some of the highlights that to me have taken place over the last 4 or 5 years, just let me list a few. These are not all of them. There's probably some that I've missed on, but number one, I think the stabilizing the field and the headquarters leadership, the five RDs that we currently have, the three men here at headquarters that make up the headquarters team, and myself comprise the U.S. leadership team, and we're going to show you a picture of those guys in just a minute. Secondly, the formation and function of the advisory committees. The military committee was formed, the Black Advisory Committee, the Community Advisory Committee, the Collegiate Advisory Committee, and the basic purpose of those was to help us overall develop, plan, and recommend activities and policies and strategies to the U.S. leadership team. Getting the best brains we could to work on the various aspects of the ministry, and each of these committees headed up by one of the regional directors so that they had direct input to the U.S. leadership team. Thirdly, the development of the Missionary Associates Program with Bill Threlkeld and the fantastic job that he has done in just a little over 2 years. We've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 27, 28 people out, and that's a growing thing. The IT program has been a growing thing. And just quickly, an overhead slide to show you the growth in the period of time that that has been in existence. Began in 1966, and in that period of time, 13 years, we've sent out, now this is just Americans, of course there are non-Americans that have gone out on the IT program too, but 105 Americans total have gone out. We have 49 on the field right now. And as you can see, the last 4 years, there's been a continual upsweep in the sending, and we like that, the way that's going, and we want to keep it going that way. Fifthly, the growing knowledge of and spirit for missions across the board in the U.S. We feel that this is a growing trend. Some of the things that have contributed to this, the travel of the RDs. Every one of the RDs have been overseas every year in the last 2 or 3 years. Some of the SDs have been traveling overseas. We've encouraged a thrust with other works. Sixthly, the 2-7 ministry and its continued growth and importance in our community ministry. The growth and development of NAB Press and its expanding out into the various aspects of its outreach. Eighth, the progress in stabilizing headquarters finances. And I personally feel that this is a significant thing that has been accomplished just in the last few months. Headway has been made on it. And lastly, the growth and clarification of the community ministry. And those are just some of the things that I feel have happened in recent years that are of significant importance. Now, in closing, where are we today? Where do we want to go? During Sandy's session on Tuesday morning, I think it was, when he reviewed the 70s for us, a lot of what he covered that was applicable to all the navigators is also applicable to the United States, only in a lesser degree. Some of the same things that we faced in terms of problems, mistakes that we made, a great deal of them happened in the United States, and we've learned from this, we hope. Some of the thrusts that were made were a lot of it in the United States, and we praise God for that. And so there are a number of areas that we could talk about as to where we are right now. But let me just mention three: field staff, gift income, and missions. First of all, field staff. In the 24 years since 1956, the U.S. field staff have doubled every 6 years. Now, what I want to give you is just kind of an overview of the last 24 years to show you God's blessing on the ministry, on the staff, on money, and give you a composite picture. And right now, we have 674 staff operating in the U.S., counting wives. During that same period of time, since 1956, over field staff, we've doubled about every 8 years to the point where we now have 243. This represents the overseas growth. This represents the U.S. growth. These figures down here are the total for both. And at the present time, we have 917 American staff around the world counting wives. Secondly, gift income. The growth in gift income, American gift income. This portrait represents the total gift income for all purposes, both field work as well as administration. And so when you look at these figures going up here, when you get to the 7.8 million here, that represents the gift income spent in the United States, that represents spent for field work as well as for administration. Then, when you look at the blue part, this represents American dollars gift income that went overseas, and the $3.2 million represents all of our missionary endeavor, plus this includes the U.S. contribution to international headquarters, for a total this past year of $11.039 million. And then one last criteria, and to me this is the most important aspect of it to me. This is a thing that I, as the U.S. director, like to keep my eye on the most, and that is U.S. and American field reps and gift income in proportion to one another as to how they're utilized in the U.S. in proportion to how they're utilized overseas. In the top portrait here, you have field representatives. That's both men and women reps. And the figure that is significant to me, the thing that I watch, is this percentage right here. In 1975, this is just the last 5 years. In 1975, it was 62% in the U.S., 38 overseas. Then it went from 64 to 36. This past year, it was 66 and 34. And as you recall, Sandy mentioned the other day that he feels 33% of the reps in a country going overseas is quite satisfactory. We want to maintain that and maybe even do a little better. Now, this is in terms of people, this is in terms of dollars. This is reps only, but the dollars represent all staff, ITs, support personnel, contact staff, reps, everybody. And still, the percentages is something that is pretty significant. And if you look at the dollar figure, the trend is not so red hot. And this is something that I am a little concerned about, and all of us are on the U.S. leadership team. In 1975, it was 63-37. In other words, 63 in the U.S. and 37 overseas, as far as dollars is concerned. This past year, it was 68% of the dollars spent on field ministries in the U.S. was 68% of it, and 32% overseas. And we would like to see that shift begin to take place the other direction, and those two figures coming closer together as we move on. So those are just some of the things that I feel are on our hearts and some of the things that God has done and is doing. I see three great challenges ahead of the U.S. navigators in the 80s. And all three of them sort of tie in with two passages of Scripture, Philippians 2, 3, and 4, and Proverbs 11, 24, and 25. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem other better than themselves. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. I feel that this is an attitude of heart that we want to maintain and have in the U.S. ministry. A spirit of giving, a spirit of looking not just on our own things, not just of maintaining that which is ours, but also of giving to the rest of the world. And then Proverbs 11, 24 and 25. There is that scattereth and yet increaseth, and there is that withholdeth more than is meet, but it tendeth to poverty. You're going to have to help me on the next verse. The liberal soul shall be made fat, and he that watereth shall be watered also himself. And that is the attitude that I feel all of us in the leadership in the U.S. want to have. And to me, the three great challenges that lie before us in the 80s in the U.S. navigators are, number one, to continue a pattern of growth in all aspects of our U.S. ministry. To continue a pattern of growth in all aspects of our U.S. ministry, not as an end in itself, but as a means to an end, as a means to reaching the world for Christ. Secondly, to maintain our staff missionary sending. Now, notice, I said our staff missionary sending at a rate of at least 33% in terms of reps and dollars, and to continue to find new ways of getting non-staff laborers overseas. This is something very much on my heart, of getting our non-staff laborers overseas. And I think, as Lauren mentioned the other day, this past couple of years, we've had around 120 disciple makers out of our basic workforce go with other works, and a number of those went with missionary organizations. But to me, that's only a drop in the bucket. I think we can do a lot better than that. We need to do better than that. And then thirdly, to develop new sources of financial support to enable us to do the above, as well as take new ministry initiatives, both here at home and abroad. And if you would like to pray something for the United States work, you could pray for those three things. Isaiah 43, 5 and 6. Let me read from the NIV, Isaiah 43, 4 through 7, the whole context of that passage. The Lord has very much laid this on my heart in recent months regarding the U.S., and I think there's some significant applications to us in the United States in a unique way. Since you are precious and honored in my sight, and because I love you, I will give men in exchange for you and people in exchange for your life. Do not be afraid, for I am with you. I will bring your children from the west, from the east. And that could speak of the northeast region and maybe the Midwest region. I will bring your children from the east and gather them from the west. And that would be Jerry White's bailiwick out in the Pacific region. I will say to the north, Reho, give them up. And to the south, Jim White and Terry Taylor, and say to the south, do not hold them back. Bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the ends of the earth, everyone who is called by my name, whom I have created for my glory, whom I formed